You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi.
And I'm Katie Frankwitz. A candidate for an open seat on the Clatsop County Board of Commissioners says she no longer believes data centers are a viable option for the county. In an interview with KMUN after she filed to run for the District 3 seat, Mitra Vazin, a retired educator and former Job Corps Center director, said she saw potential in data centers as a way to diversify a coastal economy that has long relied on timber and tourism. But at a candidates' forum in Astoria this week, Vazin said she has done further research and the county does not have the infrastructure to make a center happen, something District 5 candidate Glenn Gaither, a retired corrections officer, also noted. Vazin's opponent in the District 3 race, retired Costco executive Mike Brocious, said he is extremely opposed to a data center because of the water the centers require and the relatively few jobs a center would bring to the area. But all three candidates emphasized the need to develop living wage jobs in the county. Of the three, only Brocious pointed to specific examples in trades, the maritime industry, and healthcare. Vazin said the county needs strong jobs that are not just seasonal, but Gaither countered that the county can't afford to abandon tourism. He said many of the service and retail jobs that are part of that industry are based in small businesses in the community. The candidates' forum was hosted by the American Association of University Women Astoria Branch. The event only featured candidates in contested races in the upcoming May 19th primary, and not all of those candidates attended. In the District 5 County Commissioner race, Gaither will face Rand Dufka, a contractor based in Arch Cape. Dufka did not attend the forum. He was encouraged by current District 5 Commissioner Leanne Thompson to run for her seat. All of the candidates across state and local races who attended the forum were asked a set of questions that circled concerns around federal immigration enforcement. The County Commission candidates were asked if they would oppose the siting of a detention center on the North Coast. Vazin, who is from Tehran, said she supports immigration and providing a legal pathway for immigrants. She said she wasn't sure how to talk about a detention center on the North Coast and only had questions. In his response, Gaither focused on concerns about a lack of tools for law enforcement to address immigrants accused of committing violent crimes. He said most of the local immigrant communities are made up of good people, but that they are also afraid of and in danger from cartels and other criminal elements. Brocious said nobody debates that violent criminals should be removed, but that he would oppose a detention center in Clatsop County.
That was KMUN News Director Katie Frankowitz reporting for KMUN. Video and audio recordings of the entire forum event are available at kmun.org.
Tillamook County is looking at a budget that might not include any new positions requested by various departments, and county leaders may also look to delay some suggested projects. The county continues to face a significant gap in its budget, a problem county commissioners need to address to avoid continuing drawdowns on the county's beginning fund balance. County Commissioner Aaron Scar says it is crucial that county leaders continue to look at ways for ongoing revenue to cover ongoing costs. Timber harvest revenue was strong this year, but the county anticipates lean years to come. The county will review the proposed budget in May. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald. Read more online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. There will be bridge closures beginning next week at bridges around Young's Bay in the Astoria and Warrenton area. The Oregon Department of Transportation is inspecting both the new Young's Bay Bridge on US 101 and the old Young's Bay Bridge and Lewis and Clark River Bridge on US 101 business. There will be a full nighttime closure on the US 101 new Young's Bay Bridge beginning at 8 p.m. Monday. The bridge will reopen at 6 a.m. the following day. US 101 business Lewis and Clark River Bridge will have a nighttime closure starting at 7 p.m. Tuesday and will reopen the next day at 6 a.m. the old Young's Bay Bridge will have a full nighttime closure two nights in a row on Wednesday and Thursday from 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. Pacific County Prosecutor Michael Rothman in Washington State won't seek re-election. His second-in-command, Chief Criminal Deputy Prosecutor Jennifer Zorn, has filed for the job instead. Rothman says he recruited Zorn for the position. Others may step up to vie for the prosecutor's job before or during the May 4th through May 8th filing period. Rothman became prosecutor in 2021. He was selected by the Pacific County Commissioners to fill a vacancy. Since then, his accomplishments have been mixed, with allegations of workplace hostility. Rothman is at the center of an ongoing lawsuit against the county for alleged hostile behavior toward courthouse employees. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. Decarbonizing the Washington state economy could save billions of dollars over the next 25 years, as well as help fight climate change. That's one of the conclusions of the state's new climate action plan. KUOW's John Ryan reports.
State law requires Washington to cut its climate pollution in half by the year 2030 and kick its carbon habit entirely by mid-century. The new plan says the state's efforts need to accelerate to meet those deadlines. State officials say key strategies like adopting electric vehicles and heat pumps will save money by lowering energy bills for households and businesses. The plan recommends ways to reduce pollution from every sector of the economy. Meanwhile, conservative critics at the Washington Policy Center say the state is misspending revenue raised from oil refineries and other major polluters. The Policy Center says revenue that is supposed to fight air pollution is instead supporting advocacy by community groups with little effect on pollution. I'm John Ryan reporting.
Five seats on the Washington State Supreme Court are up for election this year. It's something experts say hasn't happened in recent memory. These races tend to have low voter participation rates, but as state government reporter Sarah Mises-Tan reports, this election could bring big changes.
Usually there are about three seats that are open for election, but five is a majority of the Supreme Court seats. There are only nine in total, so there really is the potential for a big court change. The court has typically leaned more moderate progressive, but depending on who you speak to, some who are watching these races closely think there is a chance, depending on who's elected in November, for the court to shift slightly more conservative.
That was state government reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. The new court will also be tasked with deciding the constitutionality of the so-called millionaire's tax. It's the first state-level income tax in Washington. It imposes a 9.9% tax on personal income over $1 million. You're listening to KMUN. Here's Ava Berardi with more local and regional news.
In 2024, Oregon saw the highest rate of work zone fatalities and crashes in 5 years. Matt Noble is a spokesperson for the Oregon Department of Transportation. He says all 621 crashes were avoidable, with most being caused by speeding or distracted driving. He says that paying attention to work zones on your route could keep drivers, passengers, and road workers safe.
So if you know where they are, you can plan ahead for any possible delays, or maybe you can take a different route. And also, because distracted driving is one of the number one factors in work zone crashes, you can also put your phone somewhere where you cannot see it and you cannot interact with it.
You can find updated work zone information on tripcheck.com. The owner of a roadside zoo in Coos County has pleaded guilty to dozens of charges after police raided his business last year. Jefferson Public Radio's Justin Higginbottom reports.
Brian Tenney pleaded guilty to 47 charges. Those include allegations of animal neglect, as well as delivery of methamphetamine, racketeering, and unlawful possession of a machine gun. Prosecutors have agreed to drop over 300 more charges. Tenney operated the West Coast Game Park Safari in Bandon. The zoo featured hundreds of animals, including exotic species like tigers and bears. Prosecutors are recommending a 90-month sentence. Sydney Bentz is an attorney with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
We're urging the court to impose the full sentence that they can to send the message that those who exploit animals know that there are real consequences for the pain they cause.
Authorities rehomed the zoo's animals to sanctuaries around the country. Tenney's sentencing is in July. I'm Justin Higginbottom in Ashland.
The arrival of spring marks a period of new life. Flowers bloom, chicks hatch, and on the sheep farms in Oregon, lambs are born.
Was that on the record?
KLCC's Julia Bobach visited one of these farms to find out what it means to birth new life, live off the land, and get closer to death as a farmer.
When Scotty Jones was working at the Phoenix Zoo, she never imagined moving with her husband Greg to Alsea, Oregon, much less becoming farmers. Her friends and family certainly couldn't believe it when she did, at 50 years old.
Our children thought we'd lost our minds. They were really mad at us for moving here.
After visiting the Leaping Lamb Farm in 2003, Jones fell in love with the nature, the weather, and the idea of growing her own food. But she says it didn't take long to realize she had been, quote, romantically deluded. She says the first 5 years on the farm were pure chaos. It seemed like everything that could go wrong did.
We didn't know what we were getting into. We really didn't. Everything fell apart. Everything was dramatic. Everything was tragic.
Jones remembers the first major incident.
Two of our dogs, they've got a sheep in the creek here. One of them's got her holding by the ear. The other one is like egging him on. And so we come running. We grab the sheep. I don't know how my daughter and I did it. We drag her out of this really deep end.
They were desperate for help.
I'm calling my brand new friend down the road and going, okay, I need a vet. And she goes, no, you don't. That vet's going to cost you $150. You need to figure it out yourself. So that was our very first reality check.
Jones and her husband would face several obstacles in their first year. The horses opened their farm gates and got out, raccoons killed their chickens, and Jones had to learn how to help her ewes give birth. She kept her neighbors on speed dial for when things inevitably went wrong. At times, she wanted to give up, until she found out that's what people expected her to do.
Our friends back home were betting that we weren't going to stay. And we also found out that people here were wondering how long we were going to stay. So when I find out that people are betting against me, I dig my heels in.
Now, 23 years later, Jones says she's still seen as the lamb of the neighborhood, with several multi-generational farms and logging families in the area. But Jones has made a place for herself in the sheep farming community, and she's learned how to make a living off her land. The Leaping Lamb Farm sells meat from about 15 to 20 lambs a year directly to customers and visitors. But Jones's primary source of income comes from the farm stay she started in 2006. She says one reason for creating the two-bedroom cottage was to have people to talk to. But Jones has also learned lessons from her guests.
I'll watch people trying to help get the chickens into the chicken coop or try to help me with the sheep, and they're too fast, kids and adults. And I just go, slow down, slow down. So when you talk about what else have we gotten here, it's about learning how to slow down.
Her guests come from all over the country looking for respite. Jones says she notices them connecting with nature and each other in a more intentional way at the farm stay. Jones has also connected with the land and animals more intentionally. The lambs sold for meat complete their full life cycle at Leaping Lamb, and Jones tries to give them the best life possible before they're butchered and shipped away.
I just say they have a great life and one very bad day. And it's usually a pretty somber day on the farm.
Those days were especially hard for Jones early on. In Arizona, she says she wasn't accustomed to thinking about death or life in this way. But now she appreciates both more than ever.
What I think farming is about is it gets you really close to life and death. It's so cyclical. It's plants living and dying. It's animals living and dying. It's just the whole landscape changing. I think I was very disconnected before I moved here.
Understanding this cycle has helped Jones improve the conditions of her farm and her own mentality. Now she knows the end of one lamb's life allows her to sustain others on the farm.
You know, people have said, do you regret that you did this? And no, I absolutely don't regret it. Not at all.
Through it all, the lessons and perspectives Jones has gained have made her healthier, happier, and more prepared for anything that comes her way. In Alsea, I'm Julia Bobach, reporting.
Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Department. Coming up next, possibly, with a story about a research team looking to better understand air pollution in Rhode Island. You're listening to KMUN.
Welcome to Possibly, where we take on huge problems like the future of our planet and break them down into small questions with unexpected answers. I'm Megan Hall. Take a deep breath. In through your nose. What do you smell? A group of local researchers think it's a question worth asking, and the answer might tell us a lot about the quality of our air. Isha Tucker and Leo Nakami from our Possibly team have more on this project.
Hi, Megan.
Hello.
So can smelling our air help us improve our air quality?
Great question. To answer this, we talked to Emma Blankstein.
Hi, my name is Emma Blankstein. I am a student researcher with the Breathe Providence Project.
What is Breathe Providence?
Breathe Providence is a research team at Brown University that tracks air quality in Providence neighborhoods.
Why do they need to track this information?
Rhode Island has one of the highest asthma rates in the country, so understanding where and when people are exposed to polluted air could play a role in improving their health.
Breathe Providence uses a lot of tools to track air quality. They have a network of powerful sensors all over the city.
But they're also encouraging everyone to use the sensors we carry around already, our noses.
Anyone can participate when they download the Smell My City app.
The app, which was originally created by researchers at Carnegie Mellon, is part of a national project to crowdsource pollution odors across the country.
It's an easy way for community members to report and describe different smells.
So how does it work?
When people report a smell, they rank the intensity of the odor from 1 to 5. They can also list any health symptoms they are experiencing that may be a result of the smell, from trouble breathing to headaches or stomach aches. Then the app records the location of the smell.
As more and more people started using the Smell My City app in Providence, researchers started noticing some common patterns.
Like what?
Well, people living near the port of Providence often report smells of sulfur, asphalt, or tar.
And that makes sense, because the neighborhood around the port has some of the worst air quality in the state.
Where is this air pollution coming from?
Well, there's a lot of smelly industries near the port, including an asphalt plant, oil and gas companies, and a scrap metal distributor.
Yeah, I always notice that giant pile of metal every time I drive near the water. But it seems pretty obvious that people would notice these smells if they live near these kinds of companies. So what is the point of collecting their experiences?
Well, certain toxins have very distinct smells, and our noses are powerful tools.
The smells we notice can give us clues about where those toxins come from in a way traditional air monitor couldn't.
It's a part of Breathe Providence's efforts to paint a fuller picture of what's happening to Providence's air and validate what neighborhood members already know.
There are so many remarkable people who know what to do about these things, and they know what they're smelling, they know what they're experiencing, they know what the problem is, and they know how to fix it. It is a matter of building the power and the scientific evidence in order to actually make sure that that knowledge can translate to change, whether it's changes that the community are making in for themselves, whether it's changes that are made in collaboration with city and state government.
So next time you're outside, notice what you're smelling. It could tell you more about what's in the air than you might think.
Got it. Thanks, Isha and Leo. And if you'd like to report the things you're smelling, you can find Smell My City on your phone's app store. That's it for today. You can find more information or ask a question about the ways your choices affect our planet at askpossibly.org. You can also subscribe to Possibly wherever you get your podcasts or follow us on social media at Ask Possibly. Possibly is a co-production of Brown University's Institute for Environment and Society, Ocean State Media, and WBRU.